Hello, you're listening to Guardian Daily with me, Douglas Hardy. Coming up in today's show, Afghanistan. The latest ICM poll shows public support for the military operation there is growing despite the recent deaths. Also, why students could be facing a future with no exams, but where every keystroke counts.
It will be that the computer just tracks what you're doing as you're doing it and can make judgments about what you know and what abilities you have.
And are civil servants blocking the full potential of green energy because they favour the nuclear option?
Some of the civil servants who are in DEC love big centralised energy projects, and the big energy companies have long told them that that nuclear is the way forward.
First of all, though, here's Bill Overton with the news and today's papers.
Despite the increasing number of casualties among British troops in Afghanistan, a new poll shows public opinion on the war is almost split. The poll, which was carried out by ICM for The Guardian and the BBC's Newsnight, puts opposition to the war at 47%, just ahead of support at 46%. The findings come as British troops in Afghanistan prepare to hold a private memorial service later today to remember the 8 men who died last week. The men all died within 24 hours of each other, and 3 were only 18. New Defence Secretary Bob Ainsworth will answer questions later, his first time in the spotlight. The Tories have accused the government of leaving troops ill-equipped. The Prime Minister of Japan, Taro Aso, has called a snap election after suffering a crucial local election defeat in the capital, Tokyo. His office said he had agreed the date with his Liberal Democratic Party and coalition partner if bills already before Parliament were passed first. It's understood the embattled leader intends to dissolve the lower house of Parliament as early as Tuesday for a vote in less than 4 weeks' time. Concern about the long-term stability of North Korea mounted today following reports the country's leader, Kim Jong-il, has pancreatic cancer. The South Korean broadcaster YTN made the announcement about the leader's health in an unsourced news flash this morning. The 67-year-old's led the reclusive communist country since the death of his father, the founder of the state, Kim Il-sung, in 1994. His health is one of the most closely guarded secrets in North Korea. And there have been revelations in the US press about a highly secret counter-terrorist program that former US Vice President Dick Cheney is alleged to have ordered the CIA to conceal from Congress for 8 years. Democratic leaders in Congress are planning hearings to establish how and why information about the program was withheld. The details have been revealed to members of intelligence committees, but not been made public. In sport, England clung on to draw with Australia in the first test match of the Ashes series, but Australia captain Ricky Ponting complained of delaying tactics and said the team's failure to secure a win will drive them on to greater success. The sides face each other again on Thursday for the second test at Lord's. Now for a look at today's papers, and the deaths of British soldiers in Afghanistan dominate most of the front pages. The Times leads with the army generals who've been refused more troops for Helmand Province, and a headline accusing Gordon Brown of dereliction of duty, while the Mail calls it a betrayal. The Telegraph quotes Conservative claims soldiers are catastrophically under-equipped for battle, but also finds space to mention the arrival of swine flu at Downing Street. The Prime Minister's adviser on climate change, Michael Jacobs, has become ill. It's reported he was stopped from going to the G8 summit to avoid infecting politicians and advisers there. The Guardian looks at the conflict in Afghanistan through the latest poll results, which show people divided over the conflict. And only The Express has a different lead story. They go with an expected increase in energy bills, blaming the rise on wind, wave and solar-powered energy. They report that in order to pay for new green technology, householders will pay an extra £230 a year. And they quote Tory critics who say it's an unfair burden on people during a recession. There's more news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
The latest ICM poll shows public support for military involvement in Afghanistan is growing, despite the recent spike in the number of British soldiers who've died there. Back in 2006, 31% of a random sample of 1,000 adults were in favour. Now the figure is 46%, and that's just 1 point behind the 47% who are against our continuing involvement. The government is committing extra resources to fight the Taliban, and Gordon Brown's insisting that the mission is showing signs of success. I've been speaking with Richard Norton Taylor about the latest developments in Whitehall and on the ground.
There has been a significant shift in the attitude of ministers. Alistair Darling over the weekend, for example, was saying whatever the troops want, they can get, and we'll give them all the resources they need. Now, in spite of repeated requests from the defence chiefs in the past few weeks and months, both Brown and the Treasury have said no to more troops to Afghanistan.
Is there a shift in attitude then a result of the deaths that we've seen very recently, or is this a more fundamental change that has been coming for a while?
I think it's a pretty dramatic and recent shift, the result of the deaths, the higher profile the whole Afghanistan conflict has taken over the past few days, really. I think the government was shocked by the deaths at the end of last week. And then the public response, of course, the media response. And now it's now a political issue where Clegg and Cameron criticising government policies, refusal to give more helicopters and resources to the troops. So I think now Brown is on, to put it mildly, on the defensive. He's written a letter to senior MPs saying there's a clear strategy. A lot of people say it's not a clear strategy.
So, I mean, extra resources they're promising, that in itself is not really a strategy, is it? I mean, do they have a new strategy then? Are we going to see a change?
Well, a clear strategy, which Gordon Brown refers to, you put enough troops on the ground so you'll be able to keep control of a much bigger expanse of Helmand Province. But then it's meant to be to develop the Afghan army, you know, and increase better governance and all that stuff. Build up civilian projects. They've been delayed. They haven't been done with the civilian infrastructure projects because there haven't been enough civilians or enough security to have civilians working at these projects, engineers and so on. Also because of the corruption of President Karzai's government. So it's in a way a vicious circle too, and putting money into aid projects and so on can't work until you've got security. Security is provided by the military. The military say, you know, we can't win this war by military means alone.
I mean, in overall terms, the very idea of winning this war is becoming absurd, really, isn't it?
People say we win the whole enterprise, a conflict. Winning it means hearts and minds as well as actually killing Taliban. Well, you're not winning hearts and minds at all for all sorts of reasons. The trouble is that the quite ordinary Afghan is not yet convinced that the British and American forces and the foreign forces are there actually winning and preventing them from being brutalised by the Taliban.
Richard Norton Taylor there. Now, moving on, exams could be consigned to the history books within a decade. That's the view of a leading academic at Cambridge University. Instead, students would be assessed by computer from the work they do online. It would spell the end of the summer exam season and that nail-biting wait for results. More on this now with our education correspondent, Polly Curtis.
I did an interview with Simon Liebus, who's the head of Cambridge Assessment at the Department of Cambridge University in an exam book. And in it, he made these kind of quite startling kind of comments about the future of exams. And he basically paints this picture of a future where you won't do an exam at the end of your two-year course. You won't sit down for 3 hours in controlled conditions and write hundreds of pieces of paper to kind of demonstrate what you've learned, but that you'll be kind of assessed through computers throughout your courses. And in some cases, it might not even be test conditions or a test online. It will be that the computer just tracks what you're doing as you're doing it and can make judgments about what you know and what abilities you have. So this would mean the end of the summer exam season, the end of the A-level GCSE results coming out in the middle of August. And Simon Liebus says this is all going to happen within between 10 and 15 years.
So it sounds essentially like sort of Big Brother comes to education.
That's certainly one way of looking at it. Some of the experts I've been talking to about it raise concerns about how if everything you do is assessed, pupils will never be able to make any mistakes and they'll be stressed all the way through their courses of learning. You know, from the age of 14 to 18, you'd be constantly tested and everything you'd do would count and it would be really stressful and you wouldn't have any let up. So those kind of concerns were raised. But then for other people, doing a 3-hour exam at the end of a particular course is really a poor way of showing what you've learned. You know, it can come down a lot to whether you're good at exams, whether you're good at writing quickly, whether you're good at remembering lots of things, rather than really demonstrating kind of what your skills are. So there's arguments for and against.
I mean, at the moment, a lot of courses are part assessment and part exam. So you're kind of doing both at the moment. But really, we're looking towards a future where there could be no exams and it will all be assessment.
That's right, yeah. But this is not kind of a distinction between kind of coursework or kind of SAT exams. I think there will always be a mixture of all of those things. But, you know, at the most, it could be that you're not actually kind of doing any kind of assessment, but everything you're doing, because you're doing it on computers, they can tell how good you are. So instead of going out and doing a field trip in measuring rivers, you could do that in a computer simulated kind of model And the computer can tell how quickly you can work out the distance or speed of the river and the methods you use to do it and whether they're the best ways of doing it.
So, I mean, what do you think the benefits for students and people studying could be of this kind of system?
One of the benefits is that there's a lot of human error in marking. It's as good as it can be, but it's not a science, it's an art, and different people make different kind of calls about exams and coursework. So this, in a way, could be fairer. Computers will apply things much more strictly than people can.
And there's full coverage on that story at guardian.co.uk/education. Also on The Guardian's website today, Nicholas Watt investigates the curious case of the accidental peer, how a lack of investment in next-generation HIV drugs could spark a new health crisis. More on that at guardian.co.uk health. And head to the business section for how Arnold Schwarzenegger is coping with the financial crisis in California. Civil servants in Ed Miliband's Department for Energy and Climate Change are trying to water down and delay the introduction of so-called feed-in tariffs, which are designed to boost the deployment of renewable energies because they favour nuclear instead. That's according to one of Miliband's own advisers. I've been finding out more about him from our environment correspondent, Ashley Seeger.
It's coming from Alan Simpson MP, who's a long-time committed environmentalist who in March, the government put him in charge, or Ed Miliband put him in charge of pushing through the so-called feed-in tariff, which has been used very successfully in many countries to boost renewable energy. And now it's Alan who's saying that he's being delayed by the Sir Humphreys of the Department for Energy and Climate Change.
Maybe you could explain in just a bit of detail what exactly feed-in tariffs are.
Yes, they sound very complex. They're actually very simple. If you put a solar panel on your house that produces electricity or a wind turbine or some other form of renewable energy that feeds electricity into the grid, you're paid a certain tariff for every unit of electricity that you feed in, and that's paid at a price considerably higher than the current price of electricity. And that's to give you an incentive to make the capital investment in the turbine, wind turbine or solar panels or whatever, and it's worked very, very well in countries like Germany, France, Spain, Italy and so forth.
Because it is very widespread across Europe, isn't it?
Very widespread across Europe. They've had them for up to 10 years. They are ahead of us on renewable energy by an embarrassing margin.
So why, I mean, if this allegation is correct, why would civil servants want to delay this in favour of the nuclear option?
Well, because I'm afraid to say that the some of the civil servants who are in DEC have come from the bad old days of the DTI and Burr, and they love big centralised energy projects, and the big energy companies have long told them that that nuclear is the way forward if you want low carbon energy, and so that's what they believe in. Big companies, and unfortunately some of the DEC officials hate the idea that you and I can produce our own electricity on our own houses, because that has some implications for the big energy companies over the coming decades.
And is there any prospect of changing this position?
Well, the government's stated position of Ed Miliband and so forth is to push through feed-in tariffs. I believe that the argument going on within the department is over the level those tariffs are set at. Clearly the big energy companies want them set as low as possible, and the renewables companies want them set as high as possible. But you would assume, or you'd hope, that given how far we are behind other countries in Europe, if we're going to catch up and meet our 2020 targets, then the tariffs simply have to be set at quite a generous level to kick-start that sort of renewables revolution that I think most people would agree that we need in Britain.
So is this then just the old story of vested interests using their muscle to maintain the status quo?
I'm afraid it is, yes. And if you're not careful, Labour ministers tend to fall for this kind of stuff. This government's been in since 1997, have tended to be in thrall to big companies, be it Citibank, as we've seen the bailouts that have gone on, be it the big energy companies who are whispering quietly that they want nuclear or other forms of centralised electricity where they get to call the shots and charge us what they like. So, yes, I'm afraid it's very much exactly that. And you're going to hear an awful lot more of that going forward. You're we're already seeing the energy companies saying that people are going to be fuel poor because of the cost of renewables and so on and so forth. There's a growing campaign, and we're going to hear a lot more of the fighting from the big energy companies going forward as they're dragged kicking and screaming into a low carbon 21st century.
Well, you mentioned this government dragging its heels. What if we get... We know that David Cameron has a wind turbine on his roof. What if the Tories get in?
Well, on paper, the Tories' policies look good to me. They still want nuclear as well as part of the mix. I think that's a debate that's going to run and run. I think the Tories are on board with this. I also think that the Tories like this whole decentralised energy thing because it's about localisation. It's about people taking control of their own lives, which in theory should be a good Tory theme. Having said all of that, you know, I dare say the big energy companies are saying to the Tories that... you know, they'll only contribute to party coffers if this, this and this happens. So I think the Tories are on this one. Will they stay on it in power? We'll have to hold them to it.
Ashley Seeger. A couple of years ago, illegal file sharing was almost a way of life for Britain's teenagers, but not anymore, it seems. New research shows many are now streaming music regularly. I've been speaking with Alexandra Topping about why they've changed their behaviour and what it means for the industry.
I think what's really interesting about this story is the extent to which teenagers seem to be leaving file sharing behind. I think lots of people I spoke to in the industry were quite surprised about it too, really, including the people who'd done the research. But what they tend to think is happening is that kids who may in the past have used file sharing as a way of discovering music are now using streaming sites, mostly like YouTube and MySpace, but increasingly sites like Spotify and We7 to discover their music. So they're learning about music more through these new streaming sites, which are licensed and do pay back money to the artists involved.
So, I mean, what does this mean then for the industry?
Well, I think the great news for the industry is that if the kids are using streaming sites, then they know who they are, they know a lot about them, they know which music they like, they know what their age is, often because they're often registered on the site. So they can find out a lot about them, and the more they know, the more likely they are to be able to sell them other things, not as as we heard from the CEO of We7, he was saying that you may not be able to sell them an album anymore. They may still... you know, try and find that somewhere for free if they do buy it. But you may be able to sell them concert tickets or tickets to a different concert of a related band. So you can market to them a little bit more easily.
So whilst they're not actually paying for the music that they're getting and listening to, but it is the merchandising and the marketing opportunities which these companies are looking at.
It's the merchandising, yeah. It's that is a much more, you know, much bigger opportunity for them. But also the fact that if they go onto these streaming sites, they really do like the... if they really do like the song or the album, they're hoping that there's a click-through option on the streaming site which will, you know, help them to buy the song legally. I mean, nobody is under any illusion that this is all of a sudden going to make kids want to buy all of their music instead of getting it for free. But it is a way of making that more accessible and easier. I think the problem that people in the industry have said in the past is that there actually hasn't really been much of an option. It's either you're file sharing to get your music, or digitally there's not really been much of an alternative. So this is just a new way of getting your music.
So a reduction in illegal sharing and downloading, but it doesn't mean that piracy's dead, I presume.
Absolutely not. And many people I spoke to were saying that this was encouraging, but, you know, they'd like to see more research done into this. And this is an industry that has been turned on its head and it's changing all the time. So we need more research to back this up, and we need to see if in 12 months' time we're seeing a similar drop. But, no, there is still plenty of, you know, I don't think there's all of a sudden we're going to see young people stopping file sharing and buying all of their music, although this is obviously very encouraging.
I guess the music industry really overall are taking a pretty good heart from this news.
Well, they are. They are indeed. I think what's happening in the music industry at the moment is after years and years of inertia, they're finally starting to take action on this. So alongside new companies like Spotify, like Re7, that are offering this very attractive product, they're also doing things like we're seeing Universal linking up with Virgin Media to provide all-you-can-eat download services as an add-on to your monthly broadband fee, so that music fans would be able to download as many songs as they like. And it's those type of initiatives that are really going to make the difference. So we are seeing things moving here, though it needs to move quickly because the industry is still in significant trouble.
That was Alexandra Topping. Now, finally, England defied expectations to clinch a draw in the first Ashes test. The last wicket pair, James Anderson and Monty Panesar, kept Australia's spinners at bay for 40 minutes. Our man Mike Selvey was in Cardiff for us, and he was certainly surprised by the outcome.
I really didn't think they'd last the day out, I have to be honest with you. I think the way they batted in the game so far has been pretty poor. They lacked the discipline, I thought, to be able to last that much on the last day on a wearing pitch against a rampant Australian attack. As it transpired, was based around Paul Collingwood's determination. He's an absolutely indefatigable batsman, Paul Collingwood. He showed what can be done. He learnt the lessons from the Australian batsmen. Too many batsmen in the England innings, second innings as well, got out the cross-batted shots, and it's not the way to play on slow last-day pitches where the bounce is a little bit uneven. Collingwood showed the way, and of course finished off in dramatic style by Jimmy Anderson and Monty Panesar.
And what was the atmosphere like as it became evident that, in fact, this was going to transpire and we weren't going to lose?
Well, I think I don't think you could say they weren't going to lose until right at the very end. That was the whole point. 9 wickets down, and it's been a marvellous crowd here all through the game. And Packed House today, and I mean, they were absolutely absorbed in the contest. Got noisier and noisier, and I'm sure that they really drove the batsmen on right at the end, cheering every run, every block ball. It was a wonderful atmosphere out there. I do have to say that I think that in the last sort of half an hour of the game, England rather, I think they let themselves down with the time-wasting, sending the 12th man on. That's an old tactic, send the 12th man on with some gloves, used a bit of time. Because the Australians were going to get more than the requisite number of overs in the final hour, 15 overs to be bowled normally. They were going to get more than that in. England needed to slow it down. That was understandable. They could have done it themselves, probably out in the middle of the batsmen. 12th man comes on, that's fine. They did it once, then they did it again the following over, and I just thought that was shabby, sending the 12th man on and the physiotherapist. I thought that was rather demeaning. I thought they didn't need to do it that way, and I thought they let themselves down there.
OK, and just looking ahead briefly, Mike, do you see any changes coming up for the lineup?
I'm pretty sure there'll be changes for Lords, not on necessarily on directly on the back of any performances here, but I'm a great believer that that you do play the best side according to the conditions. You do it with spinners. I've done spinners here. You do it with seam bowlers, and you can do it with batsmen too. I'm pretty sure that the 13 players who were originally selected for this game, that's the 12 who remained here, plus Ian Bell, who went back to Warwickshire, plus the addition of Steve Harmison, I could see, would be maybe a 14-man squad. They'll announce that later on today. That would be a reasonable 14. Now, I think the chances of a second spinner playing at Lords would be remote. It's got more pace in it, but it also lasts better. It doesn't really deteriorate at Lords. It seems to get better and better. It does have some bounce in it, and that might suit Harmison. It can swing there, which would suit Onions. I should think that despite his heroics here, the chances would be that Panesar would miss out there. And possibly Stuart Broad, who I don't think really has bowled anywhere near the potential they see in him. His record yet has to match the hope that people are putting on his bowling.
Well, that's it for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Douglas Hardy. The producers, Adam Gabbard and Harriet Grant. Bye-bye for now.